From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For better or worse, the U.S. military gets a lot of workout around the world, a lot of gnarly problems thrown at it. It needs great leadership. But my guest today, former Air Force Captain Tim Kaine, says it's bleeding talent and needs a big overhaul. This hour, On Point, top talent and the U.S. military. You can join the conversation. How can, should the U.S. military hang on to its top talent? What's the way? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, I should say, we will look at the shocking suicide of the young crusader for internet and information freedom, Aaron Swartz, who killed himself Friday. He faced a controversial trial in April with the possibility of decades in prison. Lawrence Lessig will join us to look at that story. But first, with us from Washington is Tim Kaine, chief economist at the Hudson Institute conservative think tank, author of the new book, Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and Why It's Time for a Revolution. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy and served as an Air Force intelligence officer from 1990 to 1995. He resigned as a captain to pursue a Ph.D. in economics. Tim Kaine, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Now, I don't have the sound of the Air Force Academy, but I've got a little sound of West Point graduation day. This happens to be May 2011. Sounds pretty boisterous and ready to lead to me. Let's listen. You can tell us where things go from here. Here's West Point graduation 11.
Graduating class of 2011. Dismissed!
Okay, Tim Kaine, we didn't get Air Force for you, but there's Army. And that always looks and sounds like a very, very promising group of young people there. You talk about how good the U.S. military is at bringing in great people and how poor it is at hanging on to them. What's the problem?
Well, it's great to hear that, Tom. It was a glorious day. I think the only difference is we had jets roaring right
Air
about
Force,
that time.
Right.
Absolutely. And it just reminds me how much I love the military. And I wrote Bleeding Talent, this book, with a lot of love. Look, where it goes wrong is it attracts great people. It nurtures them. I talked to West Point professors about this. In fact, did a survey of 250 West Point grads. Even the officers that are still on active duty worry about this bleeding talent problem. And it's not just that they lose people who go to the private sector. They sort of waste the talent internally. They have internal bleeding because they don't match jobs well with talents. They centrally manage it at Fort Knox, Kentucky, of all places. And it's sort of this faceless bureaucracy. Young officers have no idea where their next assignment's going to be, and they just start getting on this treadmill with inflated evaluations and just a mess of bureaucracy. And that's the number one complaint we have from young officers why they get out. It's not wars. It's not being away from family, the high op tempo. It's this personnel bureaucracy that's driving them crazy.
It's hard to imagine how that's even done. I mean, there's something like, 80,000, I think, officers in the U.S. military?
Massive number. And of course, when you think about the enlisted, the civilians, that's all managed, I think active duty and Army Guard and Reserves. It's 1.1 million human bodies that they try to move around. And of course, when a bureaucracy tries to do this, they treat everybody like cogs in a wheel. And when you start doing that, there's a lot of resentment and also a lot of poorly matched people with the jobs they should be doing. People who speak Farsi, for example, who are, twisting bolts on a tank somewhere.
Why is it done this way? This seems like a situation that cries out for decentralization. I mean, how on earth are they going to know in Fort Knox what every young or mid-career officer around the world is demonstrating in terms of talent, proclivity, best next step?
Why is it done this way? Boy, Harry Truman asked that question. President Eisenhower asked that question. There have been presidential commissions for over 60 years trying to study this issue of bleeding talent and how to fix it. And what's interesting, Tom, is the military actually got it right once. They went to an all-volunteer force. They realized morale and retention were so bad during the Vietnam conflict that coercion and having a draft of forcing people to serve when they didn't want to was a bankrupt approach to running a military. And they went to this all-volunteer force. What I try to point out in the book is they only went halfway. You're really a volunteer for just your first day. That day you throw your hats and you cheer. And then on day two, you're right back to coercion. Here's where you're going to go. below, Captain Tom, and when you're done with that, here's where you're going to go. And when they rob people of the freedom to plan their own careers, that's what leads to the inefficiency.
But there's got to be a rationale in here somewhere. Somewhere, somebody sat down and laid out this system for centralized promotion and assignment. What was the rationale?
You know, I think it went, when I traced it, doing research for the book, it actually went all the way back to a Secretary of War, back before they called it the Secretary of Defense, named Elihu Root. So it's been over a century. Now, back then it made sense when they were trying to treat everybody, treat labor as capital to rationalize things. They were borrowing the best practices from the private sector, which, you know, the early management studies where all labor back then in a factory really was muscle labor.
Was it to avoid cliques or favoritism or something? You know, I'll promote your son and you'll promote mine, or just to get in line with mass industrialization?
I think there are different rationalizations over the years, but the problem is that the Air Force, Navy, Army, they all have this issue where they're still treating labor like cogs in a machine, which is how all business did it, you know, until the 1950s, 60s. Mm-hmm. But since then, we have the Silicon Valley model where you really want to coddle your talent and give it freedom and autonomy. And it turns out performance skyrockets when you do that. So it's just a matter of continuing this revolution that the private sector has sort of led the way on.
Give us some examples of people, men, women, officers, of a lot of promise whose careers got derailed, and why. Make it real for us, Tim.
Sure. There's one individual who I haven't met in person, but let me tell his story for the book. His name is Dick Hewitt. He graduated near the top of his class in West Point, served 15 years doing basically everything right, better than his peers, and he got promoted essentially 1 year ahead, what they call below-the-zone promotion, and he was up for battalion command. And what happened was there were 16 jobs available for battalion command in his specialty, which was light infantry.
Okay.
And of course, he was the youngest. He was the major. The other 15 were colonels. So of those 16, you put in your preference listing of the rank order 1 through 16. Well, the 16th was a remote assignment to Korea. Now, I served in Korea. I loved it there. But when you've got two young children and your wife's having another baby and there may be some medical complications, mm-hmm. you don't want to go remote. He asked the Army to give him an exception. They said no. And when he basically turned down this battalion, this great opportunity, they put him on the blacklist. So he ended up serving a full 20-year career, but he did it teaching at West Point for his last few years. And the crazy thing is this, Tom, when Dick Hewitt asked the Army to rebranch him so he can stay in uniform and continue to inspire young cadets at West Point, they said, no, we still need you as an infantry officer, declined. So he retires. He had no more commitment to serve. They didn't want to use him as a commander anyway, so he didn't really need to be in the infantry. It was just sort of the bureaucracy holding a grudge.
What percentage of our best talent in the military, U.S. military officer corps, is bailing out along the way, Tim?
Well, the retention rates went down a little bit during the war. There was some controversy about that. A lot of people blamed the conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq. But it turns out there'd been studies warning about lower retention rates that preceded the attacks on 9/11. So, like I said, when I started digging into this, I found it was a problem going back to the 1960s, 1950s even, when Harry Truman was trying to get a presidential commission to study and find a way out. So, you know, it's never really not been a problem. There's always been mismanagement of personnel in the military. And what I try to do with the book, though, is point a way forward, a way to continue the revolution and give to basically heal and catch up to better personnel practices.
We'll look at how you'd like to see that happen, but give us a sense of what this may be costing us as a country. I guess first in people who get trained up but then go away, but maybe more importantly in terms of the effectiveness of our military. We are told again and again by our top leaders that we've got the best military in the world, you know, ship shape so great you can't believe it, but there must be some cost or some loss of effectiveness in what you're describing if you're right, Tim.
Absolutely. And there's not a way for us to put a dollar measure on that. I mean, we do have by far the best military in the world. We have by far the best talented people in our military compared to other military. I still swear by not just the officers, but the enlisted.
So what's the downside? Are we seeing it in outcomes, in wars not won outright, or in muddled conflicts?
Yeah, you know, sad to say, but there probably are fatalities that we suffer that we don't need to suffer. When we rotate people through assignments, in this system, everybody needs to have a turn being in command, say, of a squadron or a platoon. You got to have your turn. Everybody's got to get their shot. Well, why? why don't we leave a group commander or a battalion commander in place for 5 years? There's another observation that I think we've had 10 commanders overall of the war in Afghanistan in 10 years. That just seems like, can you imagine rotating out Eisenhower after 12 months and saying, well, good job, Ike, but you know what? We want to give Patton a shot. And then after that, some other general we haven't heard of.
So you're saying do it on merit. If they're doing a great job, just leave them right there.
Absolutely. Well, the one way I tried to answer that question, too, was I asked West Pointers themselves, including active duty, is this hurting national security, this mm-hmm. problem of bleeding talent? Mm-hmm. About 60% said we have a less competent general officer corps, and about 70% said it does hurt national security. That's about as good a measure we can get.
Do you think Americans could have a much more effective military if some of the what you're calling for here, promote on merit, assign on merit, if that was followed?
Oh, I think it'd be phenomenally better. I mean, ask that question. Imagine if we're in 1972 and we're debating this idea of, gee, should we get rid of the draft? It's always been this way. Won't it? Maybe it'll fail. And now we know. Having an all-volunteer force where men and women want to stay in uniform, they want to be in uniform in the first place, and their careers tend to be a lot longer, they're more proficient, it's a much better military with many fewer fatalities. I like that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the U.S. Military Officer Corps bleeding talent, says my guest today, and in need, he says, of an overhaul, a revolution. Tim Kaine is with us, former Air Force captain in intelligence. He's written the book Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and Why It's Time for a Revolution, he says, right in his title. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He's a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy. Tim Kaine joins us from Washington. Tim, we asked on Facebook at On Point Radio if the military is losing its best. Lots of response there. Juana says, yes. Jennifer says, absolutely. Seen it happen firsthand. You've got lots of nuance, though, here, too. Brian says, look, from a purely economic perspective, it's a no-brainer. Why would someone stay in a military position when a more lucrative arrangement exists in the private civilian sector? I mean, no matter what a good job you do, if you're really bringing in best and brightest, Tim, aren't people going to go off and for the opportunity, the money?
Well, it's a good point. Money very much factors into that. In fact, it's sort of a point of pride of a lot of people in the military that they don't serve for money. And I try to talk about that in the book, but I disagree. People serve for value reasons in charities around this country all the time. And what we mm-hmm. do matters just as much to us as how much we get paid. And you know, the military, frankly, it's not a bad deal financially. We've as taxpayers and citizens, we take pretty good care of our troops in uniform. It's not the money that makes these guys quit, and I should say, and super talented women. It's the frustration.
Let me ask you about this perspective. John writes, and he says, why would we want the most talented and capable to fuel this machine of domination and killing? He says, as Ron Paul has said, let's liquidate the military empire, stick to peaceful economic non-interventionist interactions in the world. Why funnel our best and brightest there? What do you say to
well,
John?
Well, you know, I don't know. I went into the military as sort of a bleeding heart wanting to prevent nuclear war. I'd like to have, you know, not just the warmongers serving in uniform. So, you know, caring about talented, wise officers and generals means a lot.
Let's go to David calling from Chicago. David, you're on the air with Tim Kaine.
Hi. I joined the military at a very late age. I'm a reservist. I'm a captain. Mm-hmm. I joined at 50. I had a particular skill that they needed. And it's, after 3 years, it's been very tough to, I would say that my military career hasn't been managed. And that it's very frustrating that I probably will stop after a certain point. I'll never be able to make retirement because of the age at which I started. But there has been no management to my career.
That doesn't make, if they needed your skill, why wouldn't they management to optimize once you were in, David?
I can't say. Part of the problem is that people do move too fast from one unit to another. There's been a real downsizing in the amount of mentoring that's been done. The number of classes that they have and the training has been done. And there's, then again, this enormous bureaucracy that it takes navigating the bureaucracy requires somebody who has a career in navigating bureaucracy.
Yeah, David, I appreciate your call from Chicago. Tim, you write about how the military does or doesn't use people who come in mid-career, 50-year-old, you name it, with a lot of skill. What are you calling for there?
Yeah, I think David was said he went into the reserves. I didn't catch that
50,
for sure. But
yes.
And that's very different from how the active duty brings in people. They're usually brought in very young, right out of college, or if you're enlisted, you know, right out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no getting off the treadmill. Once you get off, you're done. I talked to a guy who was in Silicon Valley, served in the Marine Corps, superstar, working, you know, new cybersecurity issues. If the Marines are going to focus on cybersecurity, you'd think they'd want to bring this guy back in, but they can't.
Why?
They said, no, we're a priesthood. Once you leave, you can never come back. That's one of the things that needs to change. And I think, to David's point, there's only so much knowledge a bureaucracy can have of an individual. And it's like chess pieces on a chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
If once they designate you as a bishop, you're a bishop. In fact, Robert E. Lee would have never been general because he was an engineer. He wasn't a leader of troops in the field.
But that doesn't make sense in an information era, a knowledge era. We can know a lot about a lot of individuals, and people close to them can see their skills.
Absolutely.
Nancy in Charlotte, North Carolina. Nancy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We were in the Air Force in the late 60s during Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband was sent to the bootstrap program, which is a year in civilian clothes to get his master's degree in international relations.
Great.
Then, several months later, we went to, or he did, and I went later on to Okinawa. And when he got there, he was put into a base housing officer job, which was the same thing he had done when we were stationed in Kansas. And he never got to use that degree that we taxpayers paid for.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody asked him what he does on his job in the Air Force, he said, "I fly a desk and dole out toilet tissue."
Doesn't make much sense to put in the investment in that education and then not use it. Tim,
no.
What are you hearing this story?
I've heard that story so many times. Anybody in the military listening today, Tom, has heard that story, probably told that story. I had a friend also who the Air Force tried to send back for his third master's degree because they had the slot set aside. They needed to send somebody, and it was right when the war on terror was starting. He was actually very busy finding bad guys and helping direct bombs on target, killing bad guys. He loved it. Regardless of what you think of the war, he was in the right place. But the Air Force needed to send somebody to this grad school, and he said, I'm not going to go. I would rather quit at 15 years, give up my 20-year retirement, and go work for the government as a civilian so I can just keep doing my job. And he ended up doing that. He made that financial sacrifice because he wanted to help win the war on terror.
Nancy, thank you for your call. Tim Kaine, stand by in Washington. I want to hear about your full formula for how to address this, but let's get a little eyewitness testimony from somebody who's been there. Another voice there. Seth Moulton joins us right now. He's in London today. Former Marine infantry captain, did two tours in Iraq as a platoon commander and two tours as a special assistant to General David Petraeus. Now he's in the inactive reserves for the Marine Corps. Seth Moulton, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
You've seen a lot. What do you think of Tim Kaine's warning and sort of a lament here that we're bleeding talent in our officer corps?
Well, he's absolutely right. It's a huge problem, and it also presents a huge opportunity if the military can figure out how to fix this. I have countless friends who love their jobs and were very talented at them, and they got out because they just didn't see any way through the bureaucracy. I remember when I was promoted to captain, and I got several emails congratulating me, and I really thought it was the silliest thing because, in truth, all I needed to do to get promoted was to show up on promotion day and have a heartbeat, and that was about it.
So what would it mean if it weren't so bureaucratic? How would that change the effectiveness of our military, Seth?
Well, first of all, it's absolutely true that this problem impacts effectiveness. And it's not just at the individual level, it's at the even at the unit level as well. My battalion of Marines was involved in the worst fighting in Iraq to date in 2004 in Najaf, and we were slated to take that experience and go up to Fallujah a few months later. But the Marine Corps, at least the story we were told, decided that the 3rd Marine Division, which had seen little to no combat in the war, needed to get its turn. So rather than send a battalion of combat veterans with all the lessons that we had learned in Azov up into Fallujah, they sent this new battalion just to give them the experience and let them get a chance at it.
So are you suggesting that if we'd had a different kind of promotion and assignment scheme at work, you might have had some more creative mind in there saying, no, these guys know what they're doing, just stick with them?
Well, I think it speaks to Tim's point that, you ought to be sending people who are most qualified and who want to be in the positions that they ask for, rather than simply giving everybody a turn, because that's sort of, the system that we have today. There's no reason why everybody has to have a turn at being a platoon commander. You ought to keep the best people, the best platoon commanders, and have them do multiple tours. I did 2 tours as a platoon commander, which is actually somewhat unusual in the Marine Corps, just based on the timing of and everything. And I was a much better platoon commander the second time around than I was the first time I went to Iraq. No question.
Tim Kaine, maybe, I don't know, let me play devil's advocate here for a second. Maybe the wise graybeards of the military know something that you don't, or you're not focusing on. You've been off in Silicon Valley and talking about entrepreneurship. Maybe there's some payoff in force cohesion to having this slower, steadier, everybody gets their fair share of the action approach. Maybe if you start promoting young hotshots, right and left, you lose a sense of unity. I don't know. What do you say?
I think that's nonsense, Tom. I don't think the graybeards. When I've talked to the West Pointers in my surveyed 250 folks, or people like Seth on an individual basis, including some of the graybeards, everybody knows it's an insane system. The problem is, because they've only been in this priesthood, they've not been to the outside world, except for the guys in the Guard and Reserve who come from the civilian sector jobs into the military for a short time. They have some ideas for solutions. But if you've been in the military from the age of 21 through 41, you don't really know anything different. It's just sort of always been this way. So that's what I'm trying to do in the book with Bleeding Talent, is really create a splash. But Seth, I love the point he made. I've known guys who want to stay as fighter pilots. That's all they want to do. Mm-hmm. But it's an up or out system. And so a lot of them go out.
Let's go to Jeremy calling from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Jeremy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tim, thanks for your service. I was an example of what the discussion is about.
Mm-hmm.
Senior class president coming out of high school, graduated with a mechanical engineering degree from Kansas State, recruited by the Air Force, came in as an acquisitions officer. By the time I was a first lieutenant, I actually was working as a wing exec, and I said I want to do research maybe in the area of helping people walk, or go back and become, get a graduate degree so I can be an instructor at the Air Force Academy. And they said, that sounds great. How about a job as an officer training school instructor? And although that would have been great for my career, it had nothing to do with engineering or research, and that's why I separated, and now we're finishing up my PhD in electrical and computer engineering.
But not in the Air Force, Jeremy.
No. I would like to go back, and I would like to serve my country through research as a, in a contractor stance, but I had 7 days to decide, do I want to continue my Air Force career in a way that's not related to, contributing to research, or do I want to continue with the research and try to contribute to my country that way? So I said, after 4 days, okay, I'm going to contribute to the research. I'll let somebody else have that job.
And out you went. Jeremy, I appreciate your call. I mean, Tim, we like to think that somewhere in our military there's kind of hard-nosed perspective that doesn't stand on ceremony or just the way things have been done, but that's really looking for how to do things most effectively. After all, these are situations where lives and deep interests are on the line.
Yeah.
Where's that impulse at work here?
Well, and this is not a knock on the people at Human Resources Command. They're doing the best they can to be central planners, but, central planning doesn't work. Soviet Union should have taught us that. And, even if Jeremy had stayed in, that would have been Bleeding Talent, because he wouldn't have been matched with what he should have been doing. And that happens all the time. Yeah, whether they quit or whether they stay, the system's inefficient. So trying to manage an inefficient system and trying to like ride a bike with square wheels, doesn't matter how hard you pedal, it's not going to work well.
So you are calling for a revolution. Give us the main pieces of the reform revolution you'd like to see. We'll get Seth Moulton's comment on it. But what would you have it look like, Tim?
Well, after talking to a lot of people, after the survey of West Point grads, 55% of them, even active duty, said it's time for radical reform. Yeah, I said it, revolution. So one would be just change the power of hiring. Give it to commanders. You know, let commanders hire a Seth Moulton and say, I want you for 4 years here.
You don't mean recruiting, for entry, but once you're in, people looking around who they need or want to serve with them in a particular capacity,
exactly.
Let commanders do it. Not centralized, but wherever they are.
Yeah, there are people like Seth who know where they want to work, and their commander wants to have them work there.
Yeah.
But HRC is now this third party trying to match jobs with people. It's not working.
So decentralize.
Give commanders hiring authority.
Mm-hmm.
End the use of year groups. Allows greater specialization if people want that. But big one is lateral entry, or really lateral reentry. So let's let a guy like Seth come back in, or Jeremy come back in if they want to. That would basically thicken the labor market, which would be good. And it would also end, Tom, this idea of force shaping. So you wouldn't have force shaping anymore. I saw a commander leave my unit early. He retired early because at the time, this is 20 years ago, the Air Force said, well, we don't need as many people. We'll offer tens of thousands of dollars a bonus for people to quit. And, you know, who took that money was the most talented, the most risk-loving officers. Thought, oh, okay. I can get out now.
So you're saying let people go out into the civilian sector, what, gain expertise and come back to the military if and when they'd like to?
If they'd like to, absolutely. And that means, you know, if you're one of these officers who isn't able to find a job in this new system, you don't get fired. You just have to go to the civilian sector for a while. You can always reapply to come back in. So it would end the force-shaping trauma that we do sort of every 5 years, this up-and-down cycle of officers need to be out. Oh, we've got a shortage. We've got too many. We've got a shortage. So
end all that
nonsense.
Age, seniority, you're saying forget the things that work toward that, so you might have very young senior officers in some cases?
And you know what? It'd be okay to have very old junior officers. If there's a guy who wants to be a fighter pilot and stay captain even until he's 45 and he's great at it, Maverick, stay in there.
Seth Moulton, what do you think? Will this formula fly?
Well, you know, the interesting thing, Tom, is I'm in the unique position of being able to say that I actually experienced the first 2 points that Tim just made. I got off active duty and applied to grad school, got into Harvard Business School,
mm-hmm.
and I had told General Petraeus that if he wanted me to come back, I'd be available. So when he was asked to go back for the surge, he asked me to come. He specifically recruited me, so it was an example of a commander essentially hiring someone.
Why could he do that when others apparently don't?
Well, General Petraeus is a maverick, and I'll tell you that it wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
So he requested me to come back out of the civilian world and back on active
mm-hmm.
duty, and it took about 3 months to get the paperwork done, even though he was a senior general in Iraq. I finally got to Baghdad and ran into the person who had held it up, and it was a Marine major whose attitude was, who do you think you are? Why should you get to work for General Petraeus? Do you think it's just because you have a Harvard degree or something like that?
Would it work on a service-wide basis,
Seth? It had nothing to do with me. It was about General Petraeus. Mm-hmm. I think it could, but the point is, and the reason why I bring up that example of the Marine major who tried to stop it,
yep.
For no good reason, is that it does require a real revolutionary change. It requires a radical top-to-bottom revamping of the system. You can't just do it piecemeal. Everybody has to be bought in to the change and why it's important.
Well, that's exactly what Tim Kaine is proposing here. Seth Moulton joining us today from London, former Marine infantry captain, special assistant to General David Petraeus. Seth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Tim Kaine, author of Bleeding Talent, How the U.S. Military Mismanages Great Leaders and Why It's Time for a Revolution. Tim, thanks for the insights, I guess, you brought back from the private sector and your service time. I hope hope it gets some attention. Maybe it'll shake things up a little. Thank you for joining us, Tim.
Tom, thanks for a great conversation.
We're going to take a short break and come back and talk about the suicide of 26-year-old programmer, internet freedom crusader Aaron Swartz. Lawrence Lessig joins us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On Friday, 26-year-old programmer and internet freedom crusader Aaron Swartz committed suicide in his New York apartment. Swartz was a big figure in what's called the Free Culture Movement, a high-profile advocate of internet and information freedom. He'd reportedly battled depression, but he was also facing a trial in April that could have left him in prison for decades over his hacking and distribution of subscription-only scholarly papers. Harvard scholar Lawrence Lessig knows Aaron Swartz well and joins us in a moment. Aaron Swartz spoke at the 2012 Freedom to Connect conference in Washington, D.C. He talked about internet freedom and resistance then to the Stop Online Piracy Act, or SOPA, legislation which was ultimately recalled from Congress last January. Here's the voice of Aaron Swartz.
There are a lot of people, a lot of powerful people, who want to clamp down on the internet. And to be honest, there aren't a whole lot who have a vested interest in protecting it from all of that. Even some of the biggest companies, some of the biggest internet companies, to put it frankly, would benefit from a world in which their little competitors could get censored. We can't let that happen.
Aaron Swartz, now dead, committed suicide Friday at age 26. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership at Harvard Law School, director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University. Lawrence Lessig, Larry Lessig, welcome to On Point. I'm sorry the circumstances are so sad, but thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How did you know Aaron Swartz?
So I knew him for the last decade. I first met him when he was, 12, or I guess he was 14. His parents would chaperone him around to computer conferences, and I was talking about internet and copyright issues, and he was in the front row of the audience, and he would come up and talk to me, and very quickly we became friends, and I invited him to be the chief architect of technical infrastructure for Creative Commons. So we've known each other for a long time.
Remind us of some of the things that he did, even before he got into this role as a kind of champion of internet freedom, RSS and all the rest. He was in there swinging from a very early age.
Yeah, at the age of 12, he started working with Dave Weiner to create RSS, really simple syndication, which is the kind of piping of the internet right now to make it so that information can be syndicated easily. Everybody uses this infrastructure, so it's core technology. Then he moved to Creative Commons to help us make it so you could license material freely. After that, he worked with Brewster Kahle on the Open Library to make published work more easily available. He worked with some friends to try to build a collaborative filtering system, which eventually became Reddit, and he was very successful when that company was sold to Wired. But I think the important thing to remember is that he wasn't just a computer activist. He, very quickly recognized, as I did, indeed, he came to me in Berlin and we had this conversation, and it was at this moment that I decided I was going to shift my work from internet to corruption. He and I sat in this, in January of 2007, we sat in this room, and we just recognized there was no chance that we would make any progress in these internet issues until we made progress in a more fundamental space. And he helped me with the work that we were doing for Change Congress, which eventually became Root Strikers. He worked with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which Stephanie Taylor and Adam Green had launched, and he eventually, with David Siegel, started Demand Progress, which was instrumental in blocking SOPA. But he was this kid idealist who did nothing but work for what he thought was the public interest from a very young age, and now it's over.
I have a little more of Aaron Swartz's voice here. This is Lawrence Lessig from July 2011. This is an interview with RT TV talking about on the occasion of the release of a UN report saying that internet access, freedom, basic human right. Here was Aaron Swartz then.
The internet is the most exciting, most modern, and most developed form of expression there is. And in our country, at least, expression is a First Amendment right. And around the world, it's a universal human right. So the idea that the government can come and just take away your ability to express yourself, to communicate with others, to organize, just because they don't like some of the things you're doing, I think it's right that the UN's standing up against that.
Aaron Swartz in 2011, his suicide, news of it came after last Friday. Vigils around the country, mourning around the country for him. Lawrence Lessig is with us. You knew him well, worked with him. What was it in his, what was the heart of the message that people saw coming from Aaron Lawrence that they found so exciting, those who were drawn to him?
Well, you know, there are many technologists, many geeks who came to the center of importance because of the Internet. And here was one that looked up from his computer, and he saw the way technology could advance really important political, social, cultural ideals. And he started to work on that. And I think people saw the idealism. They saw that, you know, literally he never did anything in his life to try to earn, to make money. When he was successful at Reddit, it allowed him to no longer have to work, and he lived very frugally so he could continue to push the organizing and the perspective that was so important to him. And I think people saw that purity. You know, he wasn't somebody who brooked fools. He wasn't somebody who, you know, he could lose patience with you. Mm-hmm. He could believe you were wrong. He moved on from many projects because he judged they were not, you know, fundamental enough. Mika Sifri, who's very important and who's one of the founders of Sunlight Foundation, published this really extraordinary email Aaron sent to him, where Aaron basically said, "Look, I get the importance of transparency, but it's not enough. We need more fundamental change than just transparency." And so that's why he was moving on. So, you know, he had courage of his convictions. This is, you know, this mm-hmm. is somebody who inspired people from that courage. And as I said in my blog post, you know, prosecutor is bully, I said there's a million times in my life where I stopped and I asked, what would Aaron think? It was a test. It's a question that I think all of us should ask.
We'll look at the prosecution he was facing, but before we go there, I mean, talk to us about his vision. I mean, he faced problems and challenges and interests that opposed what he saw as his or the social interest. But how would you describe his vision of what he hoped for? If the world was shaped in Aaron Swartz's way, what would that look like, and what would the special benefit be?
Yeah, you know, it's not a radical view in the sense of what ordinary people think the world should look like. Mm-hmm. It would be a world where the Internet continues to be a platform for free expression and free exchange of ideas, that has a radically updated vision of intellectual property, copyright, that protects, you know, the value of privacy, the values of innovation, avoids the government's, typically clumsy, crony, capitalist-like interference with that. You know, he and I spent a great deal of time, working on the corruption issues together. I think it was the only nice, you know, the only praise he ever gave to anything I wrote was his praise of my book that you interviewed me for, mm-hmm. Public Lost. So, he had a vision of a democracy that was working, where the values are values that we could be proud of, and he worked in every sphere of his life to push us there.
He pushed boundaries when it came to what was called piracy, and he wrote way back in 2008, he said, "It's called stealing or piracy as if sharing a wealth of knowledge were the moral equivalent of plundering a ship and murdering its crew, but sharing isn't immoral. It's a moral imperative." He, of course, was arrested and accused in 2011 of using computers at MIT to get into these millions of scholarly papers kept by a group called JSTOR, this subscription-only service for scientific and literary journals. What happened there, Lawrence Lessig?
Well, I think to understand what happened there, we have to take one step before. He had also, 2 years before that, working with Carl Malamud at Public Resource, liberated a whole bunch of government documents. These were in the PACER archive. These government documents were public domain documents. They were basically court filings that were publicly accessible. But to get access to them, you had to pay a very high price. Mm-hmm. And so he used a loophole in the access, which basically said you could get them free at a library. So he went to a library, connected his computer, he sucked them all down, and then they made them available.
These weren't classified or something. No. They were public. Just he didn't like that you had to pay to get them.
Yeah. Why should you pay to get access to a public document? Mm-hmm. It's like paying to get access to the Constitution. It made no sense. So he made it accessible. The FBI went nuts. You know, this was violation of every sort of law in the world, and they started launching an investigation to prosecute him. And very quickly, the federal judge who oversaw that whole process stepped in on his side and said, no, this was completely legitimate and good for justice. And, you know, we thank Aaron and Carl Malamud for what they did. So I think there was a little bit of resentment that in some sense he had, you know, he had tricked the system to get access to this information. And mm-hmm. so he went into this recent battle with a thumb on the scale against him. So the more recent one, and I have to be careful because when he was arrested, he came to me and there was a period of time where I acted as a counsel to him, and so I know more about this than I'm able to talk about.
Legal counsel, okay.
But what they accused him of was downloading a significant portion of JSTOR, which is a nonprofit organization that does the amazing work of making scholarly journal articles available for free.
And for free or for subscription?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm skipping ahead to where mm-hmm. what they've just recently announced. Mm-hmm. You know, tragically, they announced 3 days before Aaron's death that they were going to make all of it accessible for free.
But at the time, there was a subscription. The story goes, and I just know what I read in the press here, but that he got into a computer at MIT, sort of left a laptop in there that was feeding this stuff out to him. And is that why the FBI came after him, the justice came after him?
Yeah. He downloaded this material. He claimed it was in violation of the terms of access because of this very overly broad statute, the CFAA, that breach of access exposed him to these felony prosecutions. And so he was indicted by the federal government, threatened with, multiple decades of jail time.
I'm reading 30, 40, 50 years, potentially?
It depends on how it gets valued, and mm-hmm. that's the craziness here. But, because what is the value of scholarly articles, academic articles? Look, I make these for a living, but you and I know the value is ridiculously small.
And they're now available for free by the same organization.
That's right. I mean, mm-hmm. JSTOR has done amazing work to make this accessible. Mm-hmm. But JSTOR, after this came out, said, don't prosecute him. They said, we're not going to prosecute him. MIT was slow, and they didn't say don't prosecute him. And over the weekend, MIT released a statement to the president saying that, they're deeply upset about this, and they've launched an investigation headed by Hal Abelson, a professor at MIT, who I think has enormous integrity, to evaluate what they did. Because basically, MIT handed him over to a prosecutorial system who, wins points not by being reasonable. And though there are many great prosecutors who have enormous integrity, we don't have a good system for checking prosecutors run amok. And there is no justification for the kind of extreme threat that was placed against him, which I, in my piece on the net, likened to a kind of bullying, which eventually pushed him to the edge and then he stepped off.
Is it clear that the prosecutors were going to prosecute him to the fullest extent of the law?
It's clear after many months of negotiation, they issued a final set of indictments that had, I can't remember, it's 13 or 15 felony counts. They refused to settle the case for anything less than him admitting a felony and serving jail time. In a world where the architects of the financial crisis dine regularly at the White House, where we can't prosecute big banks for their conspiring to the LIBOR controversy or HSBC, in that world, the idea that the federal government has a fundamental interest in labeling Aaron Swartz as a felon is outrageous. But that was what they insisted on. And Carmen Ortiz, who is the U.S. attorney here, I don't think she was certainly not the line prosecutor, but when this indictment was announced, she said exactly the things that Aaron was criticizing, which I think are, really crazy. She said, it's stealing is stealing. That's all there is to it. Well, no, that's not all there is to it. And anybody who in 21st century continues to utter that nonsense is either somebody who isn't qualified to hold his or her job or somebody who's just trying to mislead the public.
We have response from our listeners. Lawrence Lessa. Gustavo says, you know, glad you're covering this. He was a true genius and an idealist with the talent to bring ideals to reality. He says, to destroy a true genius over what in reality amounts to nothing is a moral and political crime. Now, clearly not everybody agreed it was nothing, but, you know, Albany says, Obama's justice, I guess, department responsible for Swartz's death, no one else. What kind of company do you put? Is he in the company of Julian Assange, Bradley Manning? Is he in a different category? Where does he belong?
So he's clearly in a different category in the sense that he was not liberating or leaking government secrets. You know, there's a lot of criticism of what happened with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, especially when they released an archive that held all this information which could threaten the lives of people. That's not what Aaron was doing. You know, Aaron, whatever you expected he was going to do with his archive of JSTOR articles, and there's some completely benign accounts of what he might be doing. There's some, you know, the most extreme account might be he was just going to release it to the internet, but even that was a crazy idea because once it was released, you know, the government could get that shut down immediately. But whatever, this was just scholarly articles, Harvard Law Review or Psychology Reviews from 1954. There was no secret in these documents. And many people think it's outrageous that many of these documents continue 100 years after they were written to be protected by copyright. They should be in the public domain.
The press is full of comment that he had suffered depression. You say don't pathologize this story. There was real cause for him to be upset here. So turn it the other way. What would be the best outcome to honor Aaron Swartz's vision, intention going forward? Lawrence, you just got half a minute.
The best way to honor Aaron is to continue the idealism and pushing for the freedoms and the respect that he showed us and that we didn't do enough to show him in return.
Lawrence Lessig, professor of law and leadership, director of the Center for Ethics at Harvard University, a friend and sometime legal counsel to Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide last Friday at age 26. Lawrence Lessig, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.